A significant challenge now is information overwhelm and who to believe and what to do, because there is no one right diet. There is no one right approach. And as someone who's written books, I know that you have to take a position in order to sell a book. I know that as a journalist, you write from an angle. I've moved away from that now because I don't want to take a position that actually ends up with someone reading it and saying, I have to do this to get healthy. I'm like, but that's not true, actually. So it's this weird situation now where nutrition is both really simple and really complex, and we're all just falling down rabbit holes, almost like jumping from one to the other, trying on new things and trying out new diets. So it's almost like learn the art of navigation, learn to read your own body and the cues that come from the own body.
In this week's episode, recorded a few weeks ago, I sat down with Amanda Hamilton, a renowned nutrition expert, ex-broadcaster and founder of retreats focused on holistic well-being and women's health. We covered how Amanda's innate curiosity drove her to independently travel the globe to open a fasting retreat aged 27, create a groundbreaking international TV show, and ultimately redefine what it means to live a truly nourished life. Amanda shares her pragmatic perspective on nourishing the body and mind through real, unprocessed foods, restorative sleep, movement and exercise, and most importantly, learning to listen and trust your own body's cues over external data and trends, and making small edits for graceful aging. Amanda also discusses fasting, food accessibility, parenting, and her wellness reset program. Amanda's journey is one of inspiration and innovation. So whether you're seeking to optimize your well-being, navigate the overwhelming world of health information, or simply learn from a woman who's fearlessly followed her own curiosity, this episode is not to be missed. Now, over to Amanda. Amanda, welcome to the Impossible Network.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you for making the time on this fine sunny afternoon in Edinburgh and a very cloudy and rainy day in Austin, Texas. Something's happened into the world.
That just doesn't sound right at all, does it?
No, it doesn't. Yeah, time to move back to Scotland. All right, so let's get started, Amanda. So the first big question is, who are you as a human being?
I thought about this, and ultimately, I think the one word would just be, I'm curious. I'm curious as to what the hell is going on in life and what this is all about and how to get the most out of it. And I think that pretty much drives everything that I am and that I do.
It's interesting. I was being interviewed by another podcaster, actually 2 days ago. The tables were turned and asked me the same question, a similar question. And I said, curiosity and creativity. I think they're the two ingredients that are going to be increasingly important for anyone going forward in this world as AI starts to envelop us. If we're not curious individuals, you know, what does it mean for us as AI replaces so much of what we do and our capabilities? Curiosity is the thing that will allow us to retain our humanity. So I think it's really interesting you say that.
Yeah, well, it's infinite as well, isn't it? Ultimately, you can be curious about every single thing that happens in life. So there isn't a cap on it. You don't need to have had a certain type of life or live in a certain type of place to be curious. So that, yeah, as you say, that kind of very human, the essence of what it is to be human, I think curiosity, well, it's kept me happy, I guess, and has driven a lot of what I do. But as you say, with AI coming down, AI here and coming down the pipe in terms of how we all live, we want to hold on to those things more closely, I suppose.
The second big question that relates to that is who or what made you, the curious person you are? And it is an interesting one. Is it nature? Is it nurture?
You know, I think what has kept me curious is actually that the curiosity that I feel is innate, that is natural to us all, wasn't dampened down. It wasn't washed away. So I've not lost what's there in us all, perhaps as much as someone else who was more helicoptered in terms of their parenting or more intensively schooled, or I was not left to my own devices as such, but I was given a lot of freedom. So, you know, if I reflect on my childhood and things like that, I think I was just given a lot of space to figure things out. So it's not that who or what did something. I think it's that what's there in us all wasn't taken away or wasn't kind of hidden so much, not so many layers on top of it.
Was it nurtured? Was it recognised?
No, I don't, never discussed, you know, it's a, you know, normal Scottish upbringing, parents, teachers, there was nothing extraordinary about it, except, I suppose, that I was able to craft who I was myself and figure it out as I went along and make up my own games and follow my own interests. So a good example, I suppose, is that my parents are not religious at all. So there was not even a structure around that aspect. It's not like the here are beliefs. It was you figure out what you want to believe. And I remember going to my parents, I think I was about 13 or 14, saying I wanted to go off and there was a Buddhist conference in Edinburgh. Maybe I was slightly older, 15, but maximum 15. And I dragged a friend along and we'd go and, you know, listen to this all weekend. And that's what I mean by curiosity. And they were fine. Whatever I wanted to do, they were fine. I just kind of I went to Sunday school because I was curious just to see what it was like. And I was bored out of my mind. But then I came back and I was like, box ticked. No, that's not for me. Uh-huh. So it was just, I think, a case of letting that curiosity not be celebrated or discussed. It was just the way it was, I suppose.
Were you aware of the fact that you were, that's a question. Do you think you were more curious than either your siblings or classmates? Was it something you were conscious of?
Not conscious of at all. I would say I was probably quite brave as a person. Whether it was climbing up a tree, whether it was trying something new, whether it was daring to do something, I think I was more of that personality. So perhaps if you combine curiosity with bravery, you end up finding yourself in lots of situations and learning as you go along. So I would say, yeah, not so much so different, but perhaps just a little bit bolder as a person.
That's interesting. Yeah, because my perspective on why I started the podcast was an exploration of serendipity. That if you are predisposed to confront your fears or embrace failure or accept risk, you're more likely to go down the road less traveled, whatever that might, however that might manifest in your life. And I suppose that would be, you could describe that as daring or brave. And if you do that, they're likely to encounter situations, experiences, people that you wouldn't otherwise encounter. And that's what unlocks serendipity. Some people just think it's luck. So I think that's interesting. And I think it is that curiosity to open doors to go see what's around the next corner where other people are maybe more predisposed to stay on the safe track. And it's almost like a framework for living. So yeah, that's really really interesting.
Yeah, I 100% agree, because we associate bravery with, can you go and jump off a bridge attached to a bungee or something? I'm like, no, I hate heights. I'm not brave at all that way. But I'm not attached, perhaps, to comfort or security, maybe in the way that society would portray that a lot of people are. So I don't necessarily buy into a lot of that.
So as you were satisfying your youthful curiosity of going and exploring things like Buddhism conferences and things like that, how was your worldview developing? You grew up in Edinburgh.
Grew up in Edinburgh, kind of very normal suburbia. So in that sense, pretty safe, pretty secure. So as a springboard for, I guess, not having those, nothing was rocked too early in that sense. So worldview, I think, honestly, until I really started traveling a little bit more, my worldview would probably have just been, hey, this is suburban Edinburgh. This is what comes out of it, albeit with a bit more of a curious disposition. Yeah, travel was definitely when those other things exploded, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Travel to where?
I suppose early on, actually, I was traveling with my support. But that wasn't into challenging environments in any way. That was a version of what was already there, but it was still, you know, going off and competing in sport in different countries, relatively young. I remember my dad arranged for me to go to the Olympics as a spectator. That was in Barcelona. And I was off there for 3 weeks staying with a family. So they were very good at just kind of posting me places. I got to travel to East Germany when I was 17. I was writing for a newspaper supplement, the Broadsheet here in Scotland, and the editor probably was fed up with my incessant letters asking if I could work with them. So they said, right, okay, off you go to East Germany then for a week. I remember having to get out of school. And ironically, as I speak to you today, my son is currently in Germany, in Berlin, doing a history trip with his school. And I remember telling him before he left, I was like, oh yeah, mum went there when she was 17 and across the border, and then went and interviewed some skinheads with a translator. And it was this kind of massive adventure, but somebody sort of just trusted me to do stuff. And I was, you know, I had a chaperone, but those early experiences, whilst it's not like intrepid travel, it was independent travel. And again, not overly managed. So I was making things up as I went along. Then I went off to university for a year in the States. That was actually in Memphis. That was very different experience, I suppose, just different environment, seeing different things, seeing racism, seeing religion, and it's in the way that it was done down there in the Bible Belt, seeing how people ate and how they lived. And there was a lot there that actually probably became quite formative in terms of what I ended up doing and in terms of eating and nutrition and things like that. And then after that, it was South America, and then onwards in my 20s to India and Asia. So yeah, I think the key to it all was that it was all pretty independent, or I was left at least semi-alone to make up my own choices. I think that's one of the really important things about it all.
Do you have siblings?
Yes, I have a brother who's just a bit older than me, 16 months older, not quite Irish twins, but close enough.
Okay, so when you were finding your way around the world, countering different experiences, meeting different people, witnessing different ways of living, what was he doing?
So he actually has a sight problem. So he was more at home. He was more at home and doing what he could do at that time. He's had an operation since, and there's been sort of big gains in that since. Different personality, I would say. We're very fundamentally different personalities, but he had that to contend with. So he wasn't roaming around the world. He was making his way within Edinburgh.
So you mentioned that you've been these incessant letters to an editor. What sparked your interest in journalism? Where did that come from?
I think it was just a natural extension of curiosity combined with having a reasonable disposition towards writing well and communicating reasonably well. Again, nothing exceptional, but I think it was just that, really. And seeing an opportunity and being brave enough to ask for it.
But you must have had a yearning or a desire to express yourself through words.
I don't remember that specifically. It's funny what jumps into your mind when you see those sorts of things. I remember being told off by my English teacher because I would make my essays multicolored. I'd write one bit in green and then another bit in red, another bit in blue. And so I probably drove everyone mad. I think there was probably themes in there, like the green stuff was me talking about whatever it was. Can't even remember, nature or something. I suppose self-expression ultimately, but words, I'd say more than other things. I did study art briefly, just, you know, at school. I was, I really enjoyed it, did a bit of sculpture. But no, words were more, I guess, where I felt I could master something there.
Uh-huh. So as you travelled around the world, that cemented your objective or goal to focus on broadcast or journalism. I mean, was that quite an intentional sort of path that you took yourself on? And the reason I ask is, was there something through that experience in East Germany that opened the door to you to find your way into journalism? Or did you keep kicking down the doors?
I think there was a lot of door kicking. You know, my nickname amongst my friends is the Viking. Like, I just the door's closed, just kick it down kind of thing. So I think, again, that's just part of my nature. But no, the break, I think, with the journalism, definitely that editor giving me that chance, that completely ignited something. I ended up wanting to go and save turtles down in Mexico. And I traveled down to Mexico, and there was a couple of Americans there that had set up a newspaper. And I started working a little bit with them, but it was all a bit shambolic, I've got to be honest. However, the intention was there. And then from then, the step into broadcast was entirely accidental, because I traveled back up to the US. I wanted to do this thing called the season, you know, the ski season. I encountered people that had enough of a trust fund to go off and do a season in Aspen. I was like, that sounds quite cool, but I can't obviously afford it. So let me figure out how to do this. So I ended up basing myself in a youth hostel quite close to Aspen. And the idea was to travel in and out and then therefore have a season from this youth hostel. I persuaded the youth hostel manager or owner to let me effectively be the cleaner, which I was rubbish at. So he soon gave up on that idea. But he let me have some sort of pseudo marketing role, I think. And then to get closer to the action, I suppose, I ended up going and speaking to the local TV channel and taught myself into getting a job with them, where I was reading the news, and they let me be a reporter first, and then ended up reading the news. And I kind of probably slightly exaggerated what I had done before, as you do. I'm sure they know I was just a kid trying to figure my way. But again, they gave me a break, and it was fun. And that was a couple of months of live television and contending with AutoCue and news. And although it was like a small town, ultimately, it was news around the Roaring Fork Valley. I always remember the intro and the outro. I got my ski pass. I had my fun. And it was just, I think, people who give young people a break are really important, because I would have been definitely not the most polished or the best at it by any means. But someone saw something and just let me get on with it, even if I made lots of mistakes, which I did.
At that young age, and you're this intrepid traveler around the world, you're not being put off by any barriers. You mentioned Mexico, you've mentioned South America, all that. What made you come back to Scotland and settle on and being in journalism? Why not just carry on, live abroad?
I didn't have a visa.
No, well, yeah, of course. Yeah.
I think my intention was to try to somehow settle in Boulder, or funnily enough, in like Tucson in Arizona, these places that I absolutely loved when I traveled through the States. And just, it was that kind of the early, I guess, setup of those places as quite cool, a little bit hippie. I love the mountains, I love the rivers. So that was actually my intent, but couldn't figure it out. Came back and yeah, I got a job basically in Edinburgh. Mm-hmm. And I suppose for the rest of my 20s, it was, well, actually, I was going to say the rest of my 20s, it lasted about 5 years back in the UK and then moved to Spain. So it wasn't entirely successful. Mm-hmm. Moved back to Scotland at that time, or London, Scotland as it was.
This transition away from sort of broadcast journalism, to being an entrepreneur? How did that evolve or emerge in your life? And when, and obviously when I did the introduction, I talked about the fact you focus on nourishment or nutrition, nourishment, life nourishment. During those early days, was that interest, was that emerging in your life? Was there always some sort of interest in food? I mean, obviously you were badminton, the sport element would have certainly made you focus on health and lifestyle.
I would say the year I spent in Tennessee was definitely formed what I didn't want to eat and how I didn't want to live. Nothing about the people there who were lovely. It was just the food was kind of shocking to me. But it wasn't until I was actually up and running with an early career in journalism, ultimately in broadcast, that I happened upon going to a nutrition lecture. So yes, the interest was definitely there. I'd actually looked at it previously to see what I could do in that space, but it seemed very limited because it was kind of dietetics or health promotion that sounded very rigid within a framework. So that didn't appeal. And that just sparked it again. And at that time, nutritional medicine, it was called then, was in its infancy, I suppose, just beginning. Things are much more established and completely different now, but that was early. I did that alongside work in terms of that training. And then that took me to age 27. And then I decided to leave my life in the UK and the security and basically drive to Spain to set up my own company, which was based on fasting retreats. So I'd learned enough, or as I saw it then, learned enough about nutrition, got my badge. And that was the bit of it. The fasting in particular really, really interested me. I'd done quite a lot of fasting on myself. So that's where I did, age 27. Yeah, just packed up the car, sold up and drove to Spain.
I mean, intermittent fasting is sort of like de rigueur now with certain lifestyles and internet celebrities. You were early. I mean, how did you come upon fasting at that time when it wasn't really in the mainstream,
in the mainstream consciousness? It's in a lot of, fasting is built into things like yoga, for example, not in the intermittent fasting way, in a more like a, what we'd call now a fasting mimicking way or a block fast, going on a retreat. You know, I did quite a lot of that on myself, but also when I spent a bit of time in India and was doing retreats there, where actually you're fasting, but it's more about the mind than the body actually. But that was, you know, that was another strand, I suppose, that came later. What I loved about fasting was how quick the results came. And what I witnessed and what I studied and what I learned, both from what I could kind of pull from texts and what I was hearing from naturopaths principally that were doing this, is that it's universal in its application. Which made it feel very fair. It's free. You just stop eating, or you stop eating in a certain way, in certain patterns. And it just felt like I'd stumbled upon something that was kind of miraculous, that's inbuilt in everyone, and nobody kind of knew about it. So, or people weren't really doing it unless you were in these kind of pockets of either kind of extreme people that were kind of living in a more extreme way, or I guess with religion, of course, that are fasting months and things like that. But this was a bit different. So yeah, I was definitely early in that. And what I chose to do, realizing, of course, that at some point I had to make money work because I'd left security and drove to Spain to set this whole thing up. So what I did was I pitched the idea of a TV program about a fasting retreat. And I kid you not, I remember sitting in meetings, and I really, it took me 9 months to get this over the line, endless meetings about this, and people saying, well, what can you guarantee? And I talk about the sort of things that could happen. I was like, well, there's no guarantees. It's about you know, charting the journey and experience. And of course, it sounded absolutely bonkers to a lot of people. But, you know, but they're going to be in peril.
These were
in peril, you know. You're going to stop eating.
These were UK, UK broadcasters.
Yes, yeah, it was UK broadcasters. You know, and been working with the BBC for a while at that point. So I did go to the BBC first. And to be fair to them, they actually then picked it up. And I did do series on fasting with BBC. But the first network that agreed it, and I at that point partnered with a production company in Scotland, or they're actually UK wide, but the connection I had was in Scotland. So we got together on it. It was a channel who's now defunct, actually called UK TV. And we made the first, we made the first production. I was 29. So it took, I guess, from that standing start 2 years. I just had my daughter, actually. So for me, it was madness because she was only 3 months old. And we were just by the seat of our pants making the whole thing work. And we documented it, filmed it. I effectively was co-producing and obviously hosting the thing. So I was like the kind of person that was between one foot in both camps, and I was very protective over it because it was kind of my baby, and I had my baby, obviously. But I really, really believed in the what fasting can do and what retreats can do. So I was very protective, and I knew enough about TV to know that it's all about the edit. So you have to be really careful. So I sat in on the edits, you know, really, really kind of on it and all over it. And it was a wonderful team, actually, that we ended up with, because we went on for years and years and years with the same team. And what happened was that program was called The Spa of Embarrassing Illnesses, because it was all about somebody with a chronic, incurable condition, say psoriasis all over their body, within a week of fasting and then the follow-up of about a month of nutrition work, it would go. And these visual...
Wow.
Stunning visual transformations were happening. And of course, this for me, I knew this would happen because I had learned it, I'd studied it, and I was witnessing it all the time because I was running retreats myself. So the great thing is I knew that we were up against it. I knew we were up against it to explain it. So I thought, let's just document it. Let's just evidence it. And we ended up going to 22 countries with those series. And it got picked up. Eventually, we did the BBC. So that was huge, actually.
So if someone's got an embarrassing illness, let's say it's extreme psoriasis or something that they're very conscious of, is it the diet that's changing, or is it the actual fasting unlocks something? What's the mechanism through which it the transformation happens?
Well, there's many strands to it. It's not one thing, and there's a bit of a domino effect. So the actual process of a sequence of fasting mimicking days, as we call it now. So you don't need to have nothing at all. You just need to get to that level where your body's triggers this thing called autophagy, and you start almost going into self-repair mode in an accelerated fashion.
Which is how long? How many hours?
So you start burning ketones really as part of your fuel source. You get into about 36 hours, maybe 40 hours for some people, depends on how someone eats before then. And then you have to stay in that. But there's ways to optimize it. It's very individual. There's a real art and science to the whole thing. And ultimately, that's what I've done for 23 years now. But I know that everyone's a little bit different. So there's always a little bit of tweaking. And I still do this. It's still my job. I still have the same business. I still run retreats all the time because I love it. So you get them into that state, and the body is like a changing of the guard. It's like a different, and ultimately in the gut, a different set of microbes come along and actually start to heal the lining of the gut. Because when that's hyperpermeable or leaky, as it's often described, then you can just be triggering and re-triggering and re-triggering because you're almost having an inflammatory response to things that are leaking out that shouldn't be leaking out into the bloodstream. So it's like you go down to the root cause, and you're able to help the body help itself. There's no magic to it other than creating an inner state. So you do that alongside cleaning up the diet, looking at trying to keep someone in a place where they're not stressed or they're less stressed, or they manage their stress better. And then obviously looking at improving sleep and all the sort of things that allow the body to reset more effectively. So everyone's a bit of an individual, but ultimately this is universal in its application because we all have it. We all fast anyway, right? We're not eating when we're sleeping. So everyone fasts, break fast, breakfast. We all fast. It's just for how long and what then happens. And the way that I explain it is like a to-do list that your body never quite gets to. It's like the drawer that you never quite empty. So you have to like stop the noise, you know? You have to let your body get to that stuff. But we keep our bodies really busy with all our day-to-day goings on that we never quite get to that. And the deeper healing requires that. Yeah.
Wow. That's extraordinary. So you said this series ran for years. And you went to Spain. So were you essentially in Spain running retreats, fasting retreats, while at the same time doing the TV show?
So the retreats ran, sometimes in Spain. So what happened was I set up the business in Spain. My daughter was born in Spain. The series happened and I was back and forth to the UK. And then eventually I moved back when she was just little because it was much easier to be around family with a baby. And then I also then set up retreat centers in Turkey. So we filmed some of the series in Turkey. So it was between Spain and Turkey and the UK, a little bit of Thailand, but mostly around there for many years. And my daughter just traveled with me. We almost had a little pop-up team. One of my closest friends was from that time. And it was just fun. We were doing amazing, it felt like amazing work at the same time as getting the message out there. And it was a bunch of people that was lucky to kind of gather. And it was great. It was great fun.
Wow. Fascinating. All right. Well, that leads to the third big question. I think you've already been doing it. The question is, what are you working to achieve before you shuffle off this mortal coil? Hopefully a long time yet. I should say at this point, when I asked that question, I went to South by Southwest and saw the futurist Ray Kurzweil, who's written the book, The Singularity is Nearer. And he stood on stage at South by and said, we will reach terminal velocity for escape velocity for longevity by 2045. And everyone's like, what? And basically, he believes with the impact of AI and biotech and wearables and everything that's happening in the space, by 2029, we'll reach the singularity where we have our full-on artificial general intelligence. And by 2045, people will start to earn years back by 2029. And then by 2045, the potential to live to, he said, 500 would become possible with conditions, the right conditions, which was just insane.
Conditions being money? Is that what's going to happen in his mind?
Well, yeah, you wonder that. Yeah. But anyway, I need to read the book and learn a little bit more about this. So, yeah. So
what's the book called? My summer reading list.
The Singularity is Nearer.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
I'll send you, I've got the video, it's on YouTube of him speaking on stage, so I'll send that to you. They filmed a lot for the events at South By, so I'll send you that, that'll be a little taster. It's quite fascinating. So obviously, yeah, so what are you working to achieve? You set off on this path, but now you are full on, beyond just nutrition and fasting. And when we first chatted, the word nourishment became clear that it's a holistic way, perspective on living, a lifestyle. So maybe you could unpack that.
Yeah, I think as the years have gone on, I've definitely moved away from the idea that nutrition is where it's all at. You know, nutrition is a science, but we all have to eat. So we have to apply it into our lives. And it's much more complex than just picking something up out of you know, a bit of data and saying, actually, here's what we all do now. We all know that that's not how humans eat and how we nourish ourselves. So yes, the word nourish is better for me. My Instagram handle is Amanda Nourish. I've just literally taken over a cafe 6 weeks ago, and I'm going to call that Nourish.
Where?
In Edinburgh, just off Broughton Street.
Nice.
And again, this was a decision made driving from Edinburgh to Glasgow. I heard about this site. I was like, yeah, stuff it. Like, you talk about planning. I don't necessarily plan that much. In fact, I don't plan much at all. I just do what feels right next. But my goal, if you like, is just to carry on doing what feels right at that time. But I'd say there's an underlying pool, an underlying kind of, used to feel like a mission. I don't think it's quite as mission-led now, in the sense that it just feels like we've all woken up to the fact that nutrition is really important. I don't have to bang on the door so much about fasting. There's a lot of people that get it. It's more about, for me, I suppose, consolidating some of that, integrating into community, having that experience myself. But nourishing mind, body requires connection, both with self and with others. And I think that has become more important to me as I've gotten older.
I suppose when you think about how the industry has changed, and I remember when I was running track and field competitively, and I was on a macrobiotic diet, and there were all these sort of trends in nourishment or in nutrition, and things have become much more lifestyle holistic based. When you think about people like that are now in the mainstream, or let's say internet celebrities, people like Andrew Huberman or Peter Attia. And I think the book he wrote released last year called Outlive, something about the art and science of longevity, I think it was. But I think it is much more in the public consciousness, this holistic well-being. But at the same time, we're seeing devastating examples of obesity, of bad nourishment, imbalance in society. So what's going on? What's your perspective and what you see around you? Not just in Scotland, but just globally, what's going on?
Well, I think there's two aspects to what you just said there. I guess the first one, as you say, there's a lot of thought leaders, I suppose, talking about this subject. Personally, my little bit to add to that is I think that whilst we're going down the high-tech route with all the wearable technologies, and I know that you wanted to touch on that later perhaps, for me, it's like that high tech, high touch. We need to be really human and connect with self, be able to navigate things ourselves, self reflect in order to journey through that whole aspect of health and wellness properly or well or optimally. I don't think it's all about the tech, which I think is a lot of it where it's going. In terms of more looking at the state of affairs as they are now, I think it saddens me greatly, because what I see is that there's a bigger divide than ever before, because it's access to health almost feels built into your financial wealth or poverty. So access to good quality ingredients is simply not available to everyone. So here in Scotland, for example, depending on where you live, you can either walk down a high street and that just be full of takeaway food and fast food, with a convenience store, if you are lucky, selling a few items, all of which will have a long shelf life and not in any way be good for your health and wellness. Now, you might say, well, you can just spend the same amount of money and go make yourself some soup and here go and get the fresh ingredients. But if you don't have a car and you're dependent on public transport, and by the way, you might not even have an oven or something to cook on, then that. So literally there are many, many, many millions of people that cannot get there. I did a bit of work with public health and it really is dire in terms of that divide. And I think the statistics, certainly the ones that I have seen, show a bigger, a widening gulf between those that have and who are becoming almost like more and more into nutrition and wellness, and those that haven't and they're just being stuck. So it's completely unfair as it is. I remember spending time, when I spent time in Turkey, it actually really struck me, and more laterally Sardinia as well. So what I saw there is that the marketplace, like it used to be in Spain as well, the marketplace that sold all the produce, whether you were rich or poor, you got the same produce. You bought your tomatoes from the same place. You got the cheese from the same place. So accessibility was much, much more fair. So that, I think, is for me the baseline that just makes sense and brings that equality back into kind of health. It's access, initial access. You can also talk about education and everything else that goes with it. But fundamentally, if we can't access it, if many people can't access it, then what chance have we got? But what I saw there, as I said, with my own eyes and just thought, oh my gosh, what a marvel, is that you've either got somebody sending their housekeeper to pick this stuff up or somebody walking, you know, with their three kids and their little knapsack, and they still can eat the same food fundamentally. Like that's a game changer.
There's so many factors at play here. And we could go off in a completely different direction, which I'm not going to do. But it is, when you think about the food industrial complex, the fact is that if you haven't got it on your reading list for the summer, there's the new book, Fast Food Nation, the second one, the guy that wrote it was really interesting. He was on Bill Maher's show last week being interviewed. It looks like a really interesting book. Yeah, so put that one on your list. But I can see it here as you travel through Texas, coming across these amazing little farmers markets, but at the same time going down through certain towns and it's just fast food strip malls and stuff, and thinking, you know, that food insecurity that must come from, you know, there's they have the money to buy, but they don't have the access to the fresh foods. And what this guy was saying last week on Bill Maher is, all even when you go into, and this is here, but I'm sure to a certain extent it's similar in the UK as well, you go in there, you see all these different foods in your supermarket shelves with different brands. But in the US, most of these brands come from about two or three different massive conglomerates, and they're controlling everything. And we don't have here in the US the same rigorous rules and regulations that come from the EU in terms of what can go into your food. So you've got to be a lot more careful here than you have to be in Europe in terms of what you're consuming. It's crazy. So without going down that route, it is a fascinating area. Your business focus, though, has gone in this nourishment, this holistic well-being. You have got a focus on women's health, but you also do corporate work. So how did you end up with that focus, and how do you balance the two?
I think, again, I don't really operate under a grand plan. And to some degree, I think I've had to react as well to what market conditions, appear. And when I was doing a lot of television, therefore you get an agent and then corporate work comes. Other times, I don't do as much television now. It's more self-generated. And I was always the breadwinner for my kids, my family. So I said the grand plan wasn't in place so much. It was a case of, let me, I suppose, have a portfolio of what came along and what comes along. I've managed to always stick to my morals, which is great. So when I was doing a lot of television, I remember having approaches from brands that I just would not align with. And I think that was pretty disappointing with my agent at the time, because those were always the well-paid ones. But it's just a case of, in this sort of industry, I suppose, and probably just my personality type as well, I just like to have the mix of different things going on. So I do like working with corporates. I had a big client yesterday out of the US, actually gave a global Zoom to their employees, and that was brilliant. It was just lovely to work with a team that were very forward thinking in terms of what they wanted to give their employees and for wellness. It was fun to work with a really
quite enlightened.
Yeah, and a really sort of tight team. Like I was appreciating how well organized everything was, and it was just quite soothing, actually, you know, to not have to DIY everything. It was lovely. And they were just very good people. So that was a lot of fun. So when that comes along, if it's a good fit, it's actually just really enjoyable. And I do like business. You know, it's not that I'm someone who's anti big company. You know, I appreciate a lot of what the good ones do and how they all work and there's people within them. Just because I don't happen to be within that structure doesn't mean I don't align with it in some way. But the other things in terms of business focus, it really is just a kind of snowballing, rolling interest. Women's health, well, women have always been my main client group, I suppose. And when I hit 40, which I'm now almost 50, so, you know, decent amount of time ago, I remember just thinking, right, this is big girl pants now. This is when the fun begins. The perimenopause, 10 years or so, not always, of course, but there's going to be a block of time, menopause transition. And I'd been working with women throughout, looking at fertility in the beginning, actually. And then as I got older, clients typically sort of, you appeal to people of your age and demographic, probably. Just hearing it time and time again, I thought, I'm going to get ahead of this personally and really just research the hell out of it. Because I want to know what's coming. So as I did that, I just kept on coming across things that were kind of sometimes shocking, but it's like this whole tapestry trying to pull everything together. And there's lots of little rabbit holes to fall down and trying to just consolidate it. So I just find it, I love the puzzle of trying to get lots and lots and lots of different strands to come together. And I think naturally our minds want to isolate on a single cause or a single savior, like, hey, if I take collagen, all this goes away. Or, hey, the one thing in control of my menopause transition and how I'm going to look, feel, and live is estrogen. Like, it's not, right? It's convenient to think like that, but it's simply not. So I really enjoy the complexities and trying to weave something a little bit simpler out of it, basically. That's why I work with women.
All your reset programs, your retreats that you do with women, you're obviously speaking to parents, people who are also parents, maybe parents of older children. But your knowledge is so deep and you're so at the forefront of the way that most people think around nutrition and nourishment and holistic well-being. How do you guide, counsel, coach just the ordinary everyday person that maybe doesn't have the time, the access, as you said, to nutritious food, how to guide them in terms of how to feed themselves or even their children? And if you were giving some advice, anyone that's listening to this, for example, that might not be in the UK or probably more likely be people that listen to this all around the world, what would be the basics? You would say, look, if you do these basic steps, you could at least begin to start to do a reset.
Okay. Well, I think, first of all, when it comes to children, they'll do what you do, not what you say. So you have to start with yourself. And of course, they might very deliberately not do what you do for a while. But certainly, I think the habits, how people orientate around food, there's a huge influence from how their parents were around food and nutrition. So I think that's really important, not just to kind of lecture on it or dictate, but actually just to live it, and then they'll scoop that up. In terms of the lowest hanging fruit or the things that are simplest to remember, what I would say is first past the post on that is get real. get real about what you put in your mouth. It's got to be something that your body, the human body, can recognize. We've evolved over about 200,000 years as Homo sapiens. We've been hunter-gatherers through that time. Agriculturalists are about 12,000 years of that, when we could cultivate and kind of rotate diet and narrowed our diet a little bit. But fundamentally, for hundreds of thousands of years, our bodies evolved with certain rules, and the rules apply to what we eat. Now, the best example of this is sugar, not surprisingly. So sugar is in carbohydrates. Our body has to work quite hard to break it down. And our body understands that process because we've evolved over the years to do it. And our bodies can only have around a teaspoon of sugar in the bloodstream at any one time and be safe, if you like, because we didn't release sugar quickly into the bloodstream because there was so much fiber in the food that we ate. So when we start, as we have done in the tiny, tiny fraction of time, say the last 50 years or so, to extract sugar and then add it all back in to foods and, of course, to drinks, when you consider that there's 10 teaspoons of sugar in some fizzy drinks, sodas, I suppose, you realize how, you know, of course we're breaking the rules, right? And the rules are something that you can't outmaneuver because this is 200,000 years of evolution. We cannot evolve that quickly to change and adapt to how we eat and live now. We have to live within the rule book. If you live without the rules, then guess what's going to happen? There's going to be 640 million people by 2040 globally with type 2 diabetes because of the sugar. So we can't break the certain rules. And if you, it's like driving your car backwards, like it's not going to work. You're going to crash. So there are just certain fundamentals. So the closer a food is to its natural state, the better. Unprocess your diet. That doesn't mean everything has to be raw by any means. It's just, can you recognize what it says in the label? If you can't pronounce what it says of what you're about to eat or drink, you probably shouldn't be doing it. Yeah, simple, simple stuff. Thereafter, I would say once you sort that out, it takes care of the sugar because whole foods don't contain sugar unless it's wrapped up in fiber, and therefore it's not a problem. You can then get a bit more sophisticated and say, okay, well, protein is really important to have every day, but that doesn't mean it's a protein powder or a protein bar. Just fundamentally, there's protein in food and we need to prioritize it a little bit, especially at the first half of the day if you want to manage appetite. Because once you've ticked that box, your body's a little bit more satiated, satisfied, and your cravings tend to go. Not always. If you're really stressed out, your cravings are probably going to come back. So there's environmental factors and emotional factors there too. But what I often say to people I'm working with is you can't stop cravings. You can't stop liking sweet things. The environment is very much currently working against us. Like we're this, you know, we're this foreign object almost in this new world, and our bodies don't know what to do with it. So we just got to try and realign with lots of things about how it is to eat like a human being should eat, but also realign with things like the circadian rhythm, you know, night and day, light and dark. There's a really interesting field called chrononutrition about the optimum time of day to do certain things according to your diet, when you digest better, when you handle sugar better, all sorts of fascinating things like that. But fundamentally, guess what? Getting up and getting out into daylight tells our body and our brain and our pineal gland that we can be more wakeful, thus allowing us, when it becomes dark, to fall asleep more easily. Melatonin-serotonin link. So
Andrew Huberman's right to say get out into sunlight within the first 30 minutes of getting up.
So I don't say first 30 minutes. I think he's correct, but I also think you get a bit more of a window. And one thing that I'm really careful about, and I think it's more perhaps my female approach rather than the male approach, is I like to make sure everything is sustainable. So if I give someone a hard and fast rule that they're going to fail on they're never going to do it again, or they're going to feel crap about it. You know, like, oh, I can't get out in 30 minutes. That's that done. I might as well eat the biscuits or whatever. So it's interpreting what the science is telling us and making it more accessible, more digestible, more real, ultimately, or more realistic. And on a one-on-one basis, I often say to people, the whole point is that you've got to meet your client where they're at. You have to listen and not like just put your ego or your preferred route to getting someone healthy. You don't just project that onto them. You have to listen first and figure out what's going to work, and then almost like pick and choose what to start with.
You mentioned earlier wearables. I've got my Whoop band and I've got my Apple Watch and I've got my Withings scales and, you know, I have my 23andMe data, and you've got all this, and increasingly we're going to have even more connectables over the next few years that's giving us information around our unique characteristics. How long will it take for us to move beyond this world of what we think are these quick fixes, and, you know, we think that we do this, you're making a step in the right direction, but the basic fundamentals maybe we haven't fixed. And at the same time, we've got all these, you know, you mentioned going to ketosis when you're doing the fasting. We have the keto diet, the paleo diet. We've got plant-based. You've got Paul Saladino on Instagram talking about the importance of eating meats. And you go, who do I believe? You know, I'm overwhelmed with all the potential to have the scientific approach to how I live and what I eat. And then it becomes like, oh, it is overwhelming.
Yeah.
So how do we cut through that, all that overload of information and data?
We have to learn to orientate from within ourselves. So, you know, you mentioned wearable technology. I've got to say, I don't even wear a watch. I have none. I wear none. I don't refer to it. I don't use it. But I do observe myself and observe my energy and kind of see what I crave. And I don't crave things like chips or whatever, but I think that's the only option, really, because the biggest challenge is things like access to healthy food, but a significant challenge now is information overwhelm and who to believe and what to do. Because there is no one right diet. There is no one right approach. And as someone who's written books, I know that you have to take a position in order to sell a book. I know that as a journalist, you write from an angle. I've moved away from that now because I don't want to take a position that actually ends up with someone reading it and saying, I have to do this to get healthy. I'm like, but that's not true, actually. You could do this, but then there's lots of other things you could do. So it's this weird situation now where nutrition is both really simple and really complex, and we're all just falling down rabbit holes, almost like jumping from one to the other, trying on new things and trying out new diets. So it's a case of how do we find our peace with that and be able to navigate it. So it's almost like learn the art of navigation, learn to read your own body and the cues that come from the own body. Now, you have to get to a kind of base camp before that happens, right? You have to be, you crave according to what you previously ate. So there has to be a degree of health or healthy food in the system before that's going to work. But once you get there, especially got to say for women, because we're cyclical, right? We're used to having a cycle and much more hormonal change, and that impacts us physically, you know, mentally, emotionally. So there's perhaps maybe a bit more intuitive for women to do this, but I don't see any other option right now that makes sense. And then at least someone feels empowered rather than disempowered. I think I see a lot of people feeling, like you said, try this, try that, try this. Guess what? 3 days later, it doesn't work. I'm bloated and constipated. What's going on? I'll just go back and eat whatever it might be. So it's kind of moving beyond that relationship with nutrition to something that is next level. And next level might sound like it's going backwards, because I'm saying, well, why don't we stop all that noise for a minute and just observe. So I always ask my clients, I'm like, do you wake up feeling refreshed? I don't ask them how many hours they sleep or what their data has said, because it's just a number. It's like if you were to judge someone's progress just by the number on a set of scales, that's just a number. You know, so it's about more sort of qualitative data and asking different questions, asking completely different questions than you often see in relation to nutrition. I was lucky enough, sorry to digress here, but I think that the observing thing is really important, because what I've realized is that most people don't do it. I did Vipassana meditation where you learn, you know, to observe your breath and thus kind of learn about your own mind. And I think that was really helpful in life in general. So when I'm trying to get someone to be a better navigator within themselves, you've got to teach a little bit of those skills, I think. So the kind of mindful aspect of eating and self-monitoring without the requirement always for technology or reports on how things are going. It's like, well, how are you feeling, you know?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because there's a paradox. The more good data we gather, the less understanding we have, because you can get caught up with the data and lose sight of, as you say, of how you feel.
Completely. But it's also seductive. Data makes us think we know what's going on. I believe we know very little in general about what's going on in our bodies. We know a tiny amount about what's going on in our minds. So it's not like we've got this shit figured out. We don't. Like, we know little bits and it's fascinating, but the reality is we can't know everything, and we're not anywhere near knowing enough to make these kind of black and white style decisions. Like, so I come at this challenge from a different perspective, I would say.
You said you ask people how they feel when they wake up. How important do you view sleep in relation to your nourishment coaching that you give people?
Yeah, I mean, it's really important. It's kind of a superpower, really, high priority. But being pragmatic about it, you've got to be careful that you don't make people feel like they're failing if they don't sleep well. You know, there's a journey towards that. And if someone's very stressed, or if they have a young child, or I don't know, they live in somewhere noisy, they're not necessarily going to easily find that. So it's really important. Great if you can get a solid 7.5 to 9 hours most of the time. If you don't sleep well one night, repay that sleep debt the next night, and you can recover. Don't wait until the weekend to catch up on sleep. You know, there are fundamental shifts in hormones that will dictate appetite, dictate your metabolic health, that change within just a few days of poor quality sleep. So really important. Lots that can be done quite easily to do that. But I would say synchronizing with light and night and day is something that's probably missed a lot from the conversation. I guess perhaps not with the neuroscientists now talking about it a lot, but certainly what I saw in the UK was that we were all focused on maybe some supplements or magnesium or melatonin and access to that. But actually, hey, our bodies can do it themselves reasonably well with a few basic conditions. So, but yep, I'm a big fan of sleep.
Wow. Okay. So yeah, don't be looking at your phone and having blue light late at night.
All that sort of stuff. The wind down is important for sure. Yeah. Trying to, you know, not toss and turn, how you eat as in the run up to sleep is important. Not overwhelming your digestion, not having too much alcohol, that can make you fall asleep, but your quality of sleep is going to be diminished. Lots of kind of simple strategies, but definitely what I find with a lot of women in particular, you know, menopause, things like that can really disrupt it. And from anyone with a young child, obviously they can be massively disrupted with sleep.
a lot of what you talk about is just, you almost feels like universal common sense.
Absolutely.
Yet at the same time, you've been at the forefront of pushing the boundaries around holistic well-being and nourishment. Where do you see things going over the next 10 years or so, potentially with, as AI has an impact on the data that we and the fact that we might be able to track our own individual biomarkers and understand more about, even applying the common sense, we might learn more about ourselves. Are there any things emerging that you're aware of or sense that how things might change as we move forward?
I mean, the things, I guess, that I'm more excited about or most excited about when it comes to technological advances, I guess, is the ability in the future to be able to understand exactly what probiotics or prebiotics somebody needs and giving them that dose. So not leaving that to chance, but understanding that's quite a way off. And also that this is a highly dynamic environment in the gut. So again, we're hopeful that that's going to have an impact, and it might not have the impact that we think. But I find that quite exciting as a breakthrough that's going to emerge. Over and above that, I've got to say, for me personally, I'm still hunkering down and saying, you know what, I think we need to have the ability to self-reflect and self-regulate more, because it's this information overwhelm, data overwhelm, over-analysis is going down one track. And I think, again, maybe it's a case of working with what you've got. I'm very naturally pragmatic. And I'm not someone that spends their time in a lab. I'm a huge, scientist and my rock stars really admire what they do, but I don't have that training and I can't do that. I focus on the bits that give the people that I work with the biggest wins without them having to spend a lot of money, without them having to change their life entirely. Again, that kind of equality of access. So I do tend to filter things according to what I believe most people can achieve and most people can do and most people can get really significant gains from. Then the bit around the edges where you can really optimize and specialize in is almost, you do that once you've got the basic set, once you've got base camp set.
Okay. I've mentioned Ray Kurzweil and Escape Velocity. for longevity earlier. Aging is something as well. As you mentioned, the body changes with age, particularly women. But, I notice, when I probably hit about 45-ish, definitely when I hit 50, my ability to take on the same level of, I was going to say, ability to, it's actually what I could eat, it was what I could drink, even what my liver could process, and the calories that I knew that I was consuming had radically changed. It was almost like, not overnight, but I could see the difference. So you must be abundantly aware of this with people that you see, that aging does have an impact. But then again, there's also a perceptual side of age, that the way you see age and the way you think about yourself. And I'll throw in here that you've also defying age as well, because you've become an international badminton player recently, even though you played badminton all your life. So I'd just like your reflections on the importance of how people the importance of how people consider age in relation to their overall well-being and nourishment.
So that how I usually talk about this with clients or in the media is, okay, so your body's your vehicle, right? The vehicle that really matters. You've got the car maybe parked out in the drive or whatever, but this is the vehicle that you are journeying through life in. So Just like the vehicle that you have sitting outside, there's wear and tear. If you are driving the vehicle that you're residing in with your foot down on the gas and the accelerator, often then obviously there's more wear and tear. So, you know, high stress, demanding, or just placing a lot of, you know, extra workload onto your car. What vehicle were you born in the beginning? You know, are you a Fiat or are you a Ferrari? We have to have a bit of self-awareness in the beginning. Some of us thrive or survive better in high stress environments. Other people, they just simply don't. So who are you to begin with and what suits you best? We're not all the same vehicle either. And then if you imagine we're in our vehicle, just like a car on a 3-lane highway. And this, I use this one for women when we talk about the menopause, and we're traveling along. Obviously, as we are driving, journeying through life, there's wear and tear, right? We're wear and tearing in the system. And one of the most fun descriptions I've heard of aging, appealed to me anyway, was someone who said, okay, so what happens with it? Our immune system, for example, the stem cells like the SES, who can, you know, you cut your thumb when you're 3 and your thumb tip will regrow. Your stem cells will make that happen. That's not going to happen at 50. They're gone, or they're diminished, greatly diminished. And then you've got your cops, your kind of day-to-day warriors, people, you know, your traffic cops or your police. I'm trying to think of the American and the English words at the same time, who patrol and who are a key part of your immune system. But as we age, we still have the police force, right? They're still in our bodies, but they're taking way more tea breaks. So they're not going to catch the robbers quite so frequently. Mm. So things get in because they're not out on patrol as much. They're there, but they're not out patrol as much. That means the onus is on us to not put as much stuff in that's going to cause a problem. So as we age, we've got the wear and tear of the actual sort of structural stuff, and then we've got the nature of how our body works and the fact that certain things are slowing down. So we want to align with that. I talk about a lot of edits, that little edits, doesn't need to be massive life changes, but edits to how we do things in order to, you know, still feel as we want to feel. So there's that. So imagine that as one lane in the highway, the aging highway. And then we've got the next lane, which really is how our body is changing hormonally. Now, obviously, I often talk about this for women, what happens with progesterone first, then estrogen, then testosterone is kind of the afterburner and how that whole dynamic works. But of course, we all have hormones. So that brings us on to the third lane, which is stress, just the nature of stress and how that can accelerate aging on all levels. And then as we hit midlife, there are just more bumps in the road. There are more potholes. Your best friend dies, your parents get ill, your teenagers turn into dragons. Like, there's just more stuff to navigate as we journey through life. So I think what happens as we get older is we have to become more and more responsible and self-aware if we want to look, live, and feel like we did 10 years ago. You have to make the edits. The onus is on us. No one's going to do it for us. There's no pill that can do that for you. I genuinely feel pretty much the same as I did when I was 25. Mentioned badminton there. I played internationally, as you said, when I was younger, like 17, and then I gave it up when I went off to university. And 5 years ago, so at 44, I picked it back up again. I was like, and I was so terrible. It was kind of a shock how bad I was. I was like, I used to be really good at this. So there and then decided I'm going to get back in the Scotland team, as you do. And it's taken me 5 years, and I just, two weekends ago, just won my first international singles competition. So, but I am aware that it's more challenging now. But I'm playing against people the same age as me, so I'm not playing against 25-year-olds. So it's a level playing field in that sense. But it's fun to see what you can still do and actually kind of hack the system a little bit. Like Tim Ferriss, you know, he's definitely someone that I've read his books and things like that. But I think it's his mental approach to going, is there a different way of doing this? Which I really like. So I suppose overall, I would say when it comes to aging, it's respecting the fact that it's happening and then choosing what you're going to do about it, quite frankly.
Do you guide your clients or patients in terms of the role of exercise in their lives?
To a degree. So I do teach Pilates and bar, trained in both, and trained in yoga as well, actually. So I can instruct on those things and sometimes build it into some of the programs. And I certainly teach it when I'm on retreats and things like that. And then more generally talk about, okay, in terms of cardiovascular needs, the baseline for that, optimizing that. But I don't go into like personal training plans and things like that. But I think exercise is medicine. Movement is medicine rather than exercise, mm-hmm. actually. And being able to enjoy movement, enjoy how your body feels when it moves, is really important. Like, mm-hmm. really important. So preserving that, I think, is one of my key goals. Not winning. I mean, winning a tournament was really fun and really gratifying, but going for a walk with the dog on the beach, like, that's the peak.
Okay. Aside from your, I mean, you've written, I should have mentioned earlier, the book, you've got a book published, The G-Plan Diet. Mm-hmm. You're very active on Instagram and YouTube. So that if people want to follow you, they can obviously follow you there and sign up to your programs. Is there anything else you would want people to be aware of that you're doing just now or things that are coming up?
I mean, the Women's Reset is our, I'd say our holistic program that I put together with a team that includes an excellent women's health nurse. So she's from the NHS actually, and she's just brilliant. We've got a mindset coach there that's become increasingly important. Other nutrition experts in the team. And then in a way that is a community. So it's an app-based community, but we connect on Zoom and chat, and that works really well. And that's just a rolling subscription, ultimately. But all the menus and everything, as you can imagine, are designed by me. And then I have more programs that are focused on a shorter amount of time, like a sprint. So say you've got to base camp, and then you want to really push it. Those programs are called Body Transform. That's either working with me directly or in small groups. I like group work. I like community-based or group work, whether that's two people or six people or 60. I love the dynamics of a group and how that just takes its own sort of form after a while. So those are the two programs I would say I do most. If you happen to be in Edinburgh, give me a couple of weeks and I'll have the actual food site, the actual real life place you can go and order a Nourish smoothie and another salad and get your Nourish detox kit and go off and do that at home or down in North Berwick where you and I met. So yeah, I'm moving things from just online to something a bit more tangible, I guess. But yeah, programs online are very much obviously in terms of what I do on a more global basis. That's where I'm at most of the time.
And just so I'm clear, that isn't just women. You would actually take on, would you ever run a group where there's males and females?
Yeah, with Body Transform, that's not just women. And my clinic, again, if someone's wanting to work on something specific, I can work with men for sure. A lot of the corporate work I do, we've done sort of breakouts just for men's health. So yeah, I would say 80% of the time is spent with women because ultimately they tend to prioritize their health a little earlier than men do and take more actionable steps. Or maybe I just appeal to women more, but yeah. Of course, I'm not exclusive. I have a son and a partner. I wouldn't work with men.
All right. We're all human beings, and we all you know, we all deal with stress and we have worries, and you've talked to the bright at the very beginning, maybe how you're daring, but we all have to deal with uncertainty. We encounter self-doubt. We have fears. How do you deal with that?
Gosh, it's a good question. I'm trying to think of scenarios, like real life scenarios. So, you know, recently I was in a sporting event, as we mentioned earlier, and I was nervous. So just like anyone else, really nervous because it meant something to me and I worked really hard for it. I just dealt with it by training my mind for it, I suppose, playing through scenarios and just getting the work done. So not shy away from hard work. But in terms of the broader thing of maybe imposter syndrome or the role that I have versus other people. So if I'm at a medical conference, for example, where it's all, you know, doctors and whatnot, definitely in the past and earlier on in my career, I would have felt like they have more training, they have more letters after their name. How can I contribute here? And it was actually, I was at a functional medicine conference and I was a speaker. It was a really key moment for me in kind of recent times. And Jeffrey Bland, he was called, he's a doctor, and many people refer to him as the founding father of functional medicine. And we'd all said our piece and I tried to explain my take on it, which was really quite different from pretty much what everyone else was saying, which was more about protocols and X equals Y. And I'm kind of like, well, no. So I tried to convey that. And at the end of the conference, he was asked by a member of the audience, you know, what's kind of the most important thing you've heard here today? And he actually said it was what I said. And I was actually quite emotional. I was like, oh my God. Oh my God.
Wow.
So I think that really helped me say, you know what, I really do have a position here. And to be less intimidated by lots of letters after someone's name, we've all got a role to play. And if my role is actually being the contrarian, you know, the person who comes from the other angle and kind of shines a light on something else, that's cool. But also I think as I get older, I just don't care as much about what people think. I just less.
It's good advice for anyone.
I just care less. So someone can have their opinion. That's their business, not mine. I'll do me. They can do them.
Just throw in there, because you could talk about your children and the way you reflecting on your curiosity as a child. What do you actively do to guide them, nourish them as children, and to guide them on a path to become rounded, confident, daring, independent adults?
Well, I believe they're all, you know, both of my kids, and I have two older stepchildren from my ex, they're all unique. They're, you know, they're on their own journey. So I'm not trying to necessarily say everyone has to be daring or has to kind of do what I did or take my route. I've been lucky enough, and I think there is a dose of luck in all this, to be able to give them a really good education. So choose schools wisely, and I've been able to invest in that. And that's been something I really wanted to do as a parent. So I've kind of given that base, I suppose. And then I've been really selective about where I lived in terms of the environment that they were going to grow up in, both the, you know, air quality, landscape, what people are mostly like. So the, I guess the values that come from living in a certain part of the world. So I kind of made that choice very deliberately. And then I suppose I just trust in the fact that from time and space and love, they'll figure it out. And they'll ask me when they ask me. I don't really craft anything beyond that, I suppose.
Okay. What would you say you, principles do you say are important to you, or do you live by?
I mean, treat others as you'd like to be treated yourself.
The golden rule.
Yeah, the golden rule, I suppose. That's probably the main one, ultimately, because if you think about what that does, it impacts on everything. But also, I suppose, I just feel grateful for the chance to be alive. So if you're buying, you know, if every day is a bit of a bonus. I lost a very dear, very, very dear friend, and she was in her early 40s. And I think that was, again, one of those defining moments in life. You're just like, I get a chance to live. Every day has to be, every day has to be spectacular, but I feel grateful every day. So I don't want to waste my time.
Okay. Who or what inspires you?
Well, she did. She was an amazing human, and she did inspire me. She was probably one of the, you know, regardless of the fact that she ended up dying way too young, she was someone that just was exceptional as a human. So she really inspired me. Other than that, I wouldn't say there's been one particular person or place or anything. It's just life inspires me, you know. Daily interactions inspire me. All sorts of random events, serendipitous things happen, and that is incredible. So I wouldn't necessarily pinpoint one or two things other than, again, an exceptional person along the way. But keeping an open mind helps pick up on all those marvels each and every day, right?
Aside from your book and your channels and all the content you create, is there any book or content that you would recommend people consume or read that would help them live a more nourished life?
Golly, I mean, I did think about this question. I mean, a book that was quite important for me, because I'm naturally someone who's got a lot going on, was a book called The One Thing. And it was just that the message in it was very helpful for me, which was basically get the deep work done in the beginning of the day when your mind can really do that type of work. So kind of be maker, then manager in the afternoon. And it almost gave me license to put a framework around what I knew worked for me. So that, on a very practical basis, was just something that definitely helped. But in terms of other books, I wouldn't say there's been one that's a breakthrough. I read all the time. I think it's more a case of reading your own thoughts, you know, listening to yourself. Yeah. The stories you tell yourself, I'd say, are the most important stories to get your head around.
What about life hacks? Is there anything that you would recommend people do that would have a quick impact or a significant impact on the way they live?
Say no more often. Do what makes you happy. I don't think that's a hack. I think that's just a kind of way to live. Align with nature as much as is possible in terms of how you eat, how you move, how you interact with the environment. Again, not quite a hack, but in terms of these short, quick wins, I think that's kind of the biggest one.
Okay. Any documentary, show, movie that you've seen that you think people should be aware of and watch?
See, I'm a terrible consumer, really. I spend much more time in my own head than I do consuming media. I don't shop very much. Like, I just don't my thing. I suppose not specific to nutrition in any way, but which I think is something I actually enjoyed and moved me, was the documentary My Octopus Teacher, was it? It's just something for pure enjoyment.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
I got to say, that made me cry. And just how it was crafted as a piece of media, and how well he told the story. I just loved it. I thought that's stuck in my mind. You know, it's things that stay with you. And I'd read, I think it's called The Beautiful Mind. about octopuses, basically, and how they are almost like aliens living on Earth because they have minds like in each of their legs. So just these kind of weird books that I pick up and read. And I just thought, that's incredible, like truly incredible, that we have these creatures that are kind of almost like they've been spliced off evolution and they are doing things differently and we're not even that aware of it. So I'd read that book and then I'd watched that documentary. So I was just like, wow. That just pure interest in Marvel, I would say that's a good one.
Okay. We believe in reciprocity. So if you're open to it, are you open for me connecting you to other guests on the podcast and engineering random collisions, as I like to call them?
Engineering serendipity. Of course, absolutely. 100%. Yeah. 100%.
Okay.
I look forward to it.
Okay. And that leads to the last question. Who do I interview next?
Ah. Oh my gosh. Right. I never thought of that one. For some reason, I missed that question.
Someone in your network.
Nicola Henderson. So she is, she works with me. She's a mindset coach, but her story is, if she's willing to share it, is incredible. And I get a lot of emails incoming, a lot of people requesting things, a lot of people asking maybe to work with me or, you know, lots of that sort of stuff. And there was something about her email, this is a few years ago, that just caught my eye, or rather caught a feeling. I was like, there was an instinct. I was like, I think there's something different here. So I did what I never have done, which was I just invited her to my house. And I was like, come and hang out for the afternoon. And we did. And she's now one of my closest friends. We work together. But I also think she's really incredible at what she does. Yeah, going to have a chat with her. And she's got the nicest Irish voice you could never imagine.
Do you describe her as a mindset?
Mindset coach.
What is that?
A life coach, but working with someone's mindset, helping them understand their own life and why they do certain things and helping them to improve their habits. Yeah.
Fascinating. Okay. Well, definitely reach out. Thank you very much, Amanda. I appreciate it for sharing your story, your journey, your daring, independent journey of curiosity and enriching other people's lives and hopefully transforming them through your nourishment, coaching and guidance. So, and more power to you. Let's look forward to being in Edinburgh at some point this summer and coming by the cafe.
Absolutely. Smoothies on me.
There you go. I'll see you. All right.
Thank you.
That's all for now, folks. Now, here's my ask of you. Please follow this podcast on Apple or Spotify or whatever player you use. Also, please subscribe to our new Random Collisions newsletter. We really are working to build a global community of action takers, action engines of people that really care about the problems that need solving. Thank you very much, and see you next time.